From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. The business journalist Brad Stone describes his biography of Jeff Bezos as an attempt to chronicle the rise of the innovative, disruptive, and polarizing powerhouse that is Amazon.com. Amazon is Bezos, of course. And Stone's book is the story behind this relentless thinker and innovator whose personal vision has transformed the way we shop, even the way we read. It's a complicated story, of course. Amazon is remarkably successful, but also it can be ruthless and predatory. We'll talk about Jeff Bezos today, about his personal story, about the way he thinks, and about the grandiose idea at the center of it all, one massive single online store that sells you everything. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we hope you'll consider joining them. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. Visit us online at KUER.org for details. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a story Brad Stone tells in his new book about Amazon.com founder Jeff Bezos. This is in the early days of the company before it had become the disruptive powerhouse it is today. Bezos had traveled to speak at Harvard Business School. This was 1996. It was a time when all kinds of retailers were moving online. And so the students there could be forgiven for being skeptical of the prospects for a retailer who was selling books on the internet. Stone reports that after his talk, about an hour-long talk, one student came up to him and said, "Look, you really seem like a nice guy, so don't take this the wrong way, but you really do need to sell to Barnes & Noble and get out now." And it's a funny story now in retrospect, in light of the fact that Amazon cleared $60 billion in sales last year, and of course it has become much more than an online bookseller. You can get movies and music and electronics and clothing, auto parts, even groceries. But what's most interesting about the story is that the student so underestimated Jeff Bezos and what Stone calls his vast ambitions. Today in the program, Brad Stone is joining us to talk about his book called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. Brad Stone has covered Amazon and technology in Silicon Valley for 15 years now. He's a senior writer for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he's joining us today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. Brad Stone, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Doug. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to begin with another story that you tell in the book really early on about how you stumbled upon this book about gifted children in public education, which tells the early a part of the early life story of Jeff Bezos, though it doesn't use his real name. Start there about finding that book, because that seems really remarkable.
Sure. I mean, right. Bezos has changed the world. And here we have this glimpse of him as a sixth grader. Well, obviously, Jeff Bezos has been in the public eye for many years. He was Time Man of the Year in 1999. And nestled in one of the early profiles in Wired magazine was a reference to this book. Yeah. I think that Jeff's mother had told a Wired reporter about it. The reporter hadn't seen it, but mentioned it, that Jeff, under this assumed name of Tim, was profiled in a book about gifted education in Texas in the 1970s. And so as I began to assemble my reporting and kind of make a list of what threads I wanted to pull, I decided to try to find that book and to find the author. The book is called Turning on Bright Minds, right. A Parent's Look at Gifted Education in Texas. It was never officially published. It was self-published. And I found a copy in the Houston Public Library. And then I found the author, Julie Ray, in Texas. And it's remarkable because it's this glimpse of a kid who is already remarkable in a lot of ways. He's reading a lot of books. The teachers are all enamored with his intellect. He's tinkering a lot in his garage, and he's building a contraption called an infinity cube. And the funny thing about that is he tells Julie Ray here in the 1970s that his Infinity Cube is cheaper than right. the ones that you can get. So already yeah. he's competitive on price. And there's lots of other tidbits from that story that just give us a glimpse of a child who's already precocious and already kind of dreaming of big things.
When did you decide that you wanted to write a book about Bezos? And what did you figure the book was going to be about, at least when you were thinking about it in the early days?
I've covered Amazon and Silicon Valley for many years, and from my perch here in San Francisco, I've seen many technology books about Google and Apple and even relatively new companies like Facebook. And there had never really been, I thought, a credible Amazon book, and in part because the company is so secretive yeah. and mysterious and kind of cordoned off up in Seattle. I had been talking to my friends in the publishing world about an Amazon book for many years, and actually there didn't seem to be a lot of interest. And then in 2010, 2011, when Walter Isaacson wrote the book about Steve Jobs, mm-hmm. and when Amazon really started to impact the world in a big way, you know, not just as a retail site, but with the Kindle, with its cloud business, Amazon Web Services, I saw the kind of interest level go way up. And you know, because the Isaacson book had done so well, I formally proposed it. And so even though I had been thinking about it for many years, it was really a project that kind of gathered momentum in 2010.
You tell the story about going to Bezos to kind of make the pitch to see if he'll cooperate with the book. And you decide to prepare this presentation, which is a lot like the presentations used within the sort of Amazon culture. It's one of those customs that we'll talk about a little bit later. But I wanted you to tell that story about you actually approach Bezos with this presentation, this, and you really make him laugh.
Well, that's easy. He's an easy laugh. But, you know, I knew enough to know that Amazon's kind of reflexive response to this project was going to be a challenging one. They're secretive. You know, they're like a lot of retailers. You don't hear Walmart or Nordstrom's, for that matter, talking a lot about their operations. And, right. and Bezos, in particular, has his eye on the future, you know, doesn't like to reveal a lot. You know, the thing that he has told other authors that I had heard was that it is too early to tell the Amazon story, mm-hmm. which is a little remarkable when you think that this is a 20-year-old company that has changed the world.
Yeah.
But I had a pretty good relationship with the company at the time, and I, you know, knew that they started all their meetings with these documents called narratives, basically 6-page documents yeah. Where everybody sits quietly reading, and new products are presented in the form of a press release. So I brought him a press release about my book, and that was kind of the conversation starter.
You mentioned how he is, when you talk to him, he really gives you your full attention, that in some way, for someone who's so intense, that may be remarkable, but he doesn't seem to be distracted or looking around. I mean, when he seems like he's genuinely interested and people are engaged anyway.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And one of the things I kind of learned about Jeff Bezos' leadership style is he goes deep. He really does. He, you know, this company now is incredibly varied. You know, it's an enterprise software company. It's a hardware company. It's a retailer. And Bezos himself, you know, he owns the Washington Post. He runs a space company on the side called Blue Origin. And I think he, you know, one of his incredible and probably very unique strengths is this versatility. And you sense it as a journalist in the room with him. Look, I mean, it's frustrating to talk to any technology CEO. And of course, as with all things, he does public relations very well, and he speaks to his customer. Sometimes he's talking over the head of the journalist in the room, you know, speaking to his customer, saying what he wants to say in a very disciplined way. But you know, he is personable. You know, some readers of the book have thought that the portrait of him isn't all that favorable, and have actually question whether I even sort of admire him or like him. And I definitely do. You know, to talk to him is he's engaging and personable. He's got that easy laugh, which sure in some context can be a little scary because it's a loud barking laugh.
Yeah.
But he engages, and he, you know, when I went to present him to the book, he really wanted to understand what my goals were. he asked me, to my surprise and consternation, how I was going to handle the narrative fallacy.
Yeah.
And this is a concept from a book called The Black Swan that basically alleges that humans are inclined to fit complex and messy stories into easy narratives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so he was asking me in a way, you know, how I was going to tell the Amazon story, which is so messy and so many things are happening at once, like the creation of the Kindle and the creation of Amazon Web Services. How am I going to lay all that out in a way that's understandable for mainstream readers? And it was a very fair question. And it was a thoughtful question.
Yeah.
And it was one that, you know, I ultimately really had to struggle with as I tried to write this book.
Well, as you said, he talks about the fact that that it maybe he thinks anyway it's too early to tell the story of Amazon, and I don't know what he's getting at with that question to you about the narrative fallacy, but is he right in some way? Is this, at least in the sense that this is an incredibly complicated story to tell, that you've really got to dig down if you're going to get it right?
I think that's right. I mean, I think that what it boils down to, frankly, is that I'm not sure Amazon really wants to be all that well understood.
Hmm.
You know, it yeah. is a company on a mission,
right.
And that mission is to be, you know, the biggest retailer in the world. You know, and it is moving so fast in so many different dimensions. You know, right now in San Francisco, where I live, they're starting to run grocery trucks around the city to deliver food and yeah. vegetables, perishables. It's a major, risky new initiative. You know, they're starting apparel businesses, and they've opened a photography studio in New York to take pictures of the models wearing the clothes. You know, they started selling art. They started selling wine. This is why I titled the book The Everything Store.
Yeah.
And it's what he, you know, what Jeff means when he says it's too early. But I think that these are incredibly competitive markets. And, you know, the Walmarts and eBays and Targets of the world are now well awake to the threat posed by Amazon and its model.
Mm.
And I just think that, you know, the narrative fallacy question, saying it's too early to tell the Amazon story, the public relations style that we see from Bezos and that he displayed recently in that 60 Minutes presentation, where, you know, they speak kind of simply and to their customers. It's strategic. You know,
yeah.
they're on a mission. They've got huge goals, and they don't want to stop and kind of reveal too much of what they're doing.
And I guess we should say, to his credit, he does cooperate with you. I'm not sure how cooperative he was, but I'm not sure if he gave you a green light necessarily, but he does cooperate to some degree.
Well, yeah. So let me recount the exact nature of the cooperation, because it was helpful.
Yeah.
He allowed me to talk to some senior members of his management team. He allowed me to talk to his parents. He approved interviews with friends and former colleagues that asked him whether it was okay to talk to me. But then he didn't settle down for any kind of reflection.
Yeah.
It's just not something that he does, which is fine. In a way, having talked to him many times over the years and seeing him give many interviews, because he speaks to his customers, he's never been a kind of reliable narrator about Amazon's own history. It's not how he communicates to the media. So Amazon was helpful to an extent, but really I built the foundation of the book through hundreds of interviews with current and former employees, the investment bankers and analysts, the competitors and partners that had basically been witness to this incredible revolution.
Mm. You mentioned in the book how Americans are often skeptical of the kind of corporate power a company like Amazon has. And this is the thing that comes up a lot, and we'll actually get back to this question, the influence or impact anyway of Amazon on local businesses, local communities. But you also say there's this contradiction in the public's, as you put it, collective psyche, that we want things cheap. But we also, on the other hand, don't want anyone undercutting the mom and pop store down the street, the local bookshop. This I wanted to ask you about that.
Sure. To maybe tease that apart a little bit, some Americans are skeptical. I mean, Walmart, you know, has 400-some billion
yeah.
in U.S. sales.
Yeah.
So clearly, you know, there are many shoppers enjoying the low prices and massive selection without the ping in their conscience that they might be putting the mom and pop store out of business.
Right.
So, you know, I think there are There are skeptics. There are media critics. And this is we've seen this for the last, 100 years since the great A&P grocery chain, to Sears and Woolworths and Kmart and Walmart and now Amazon. These retailers get so big and so good at driving down prices and employing mass groups of employees at very low wages and making their operations so efficient that they start that these companies all start to have negative effects on the economies around them. I mean, there are positive things about it. You know, Walmart's low prices enable large populations of the world to live better lives. Mm-hmm. But also, low prices drive manufacturers to push their operations overseas where they can make their products more cheaply. They drive local merchants out of business. Yeah. And I think Amazon now, $61 billion in sales last year, probably about $75 billion this year, is starting to have that same impact. And you see the questions rising up every week, from the conditions of workers in the warehouses to the effect of, prices, their prices and their ability to use software to drive prices down and to match any low price that's anywhere else. That impacts retailers and how they can pay their people and support their operations. So kind of the Amazon effect is we're just learning what that is. And like the giant discount scale retailers of the past, there are a lot of good things about the Amazon effect and there are a lot of things to worry about.
Brad Stone is with us. His book is called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the founder of Amazon.com, Jeff Bezos. The journalist Brad Stone has written a biography called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. So Brad Stone, explain Jeff Bezos' relationship with David Shaw. He described him as a soulmate, David Shaw, and he said he was one of the few people who had a fully developed left and right brain.
Right. So this is going way back to the early 90s where Jeff Bezos is a vice president at a New York City, a Wall Street hedge fund called D.E. Shaw. Mm-hmm. This is a quantitative hedge fund. It's one of the first hedge funds to use software and algorithms to identify market opportunities. And David Shaw is the genius founder. And Jeff Bezos is kind of his right-hand man. Yeah. Jeff's starting new businesses for David Shaw. And Shaw is an academic. He was a professor at Columbia University. And at Columbia, he used the internet, the very, early versions of the internet. And so we saw it coming before a lot of people. And starting in about late 1993, early 94, Shaw and Bezos were meeting weekly to brainstorm new ideas. In a lot of ways, D.E. Shaw is a kind of early version of Amazon. It's not really just a hedge fund, or at least Shaw doesn't think of it that way. He thinks of it as a technology company whose first market is finance, just like Amazon is a technology company whose first market was retail. Bezos learned a lot of things from David Shaw. And as they're meeting and brainstorming ideas, one of the ideas that they come up with is the notion of an everything store. Yeah. Can you use the web, the World Wide Web, as an intermediary between manufacturers and customers? And Bezos goes off on his own and kind of narrows that down, realizes that to be successful, you'd probably need to focus on a product category, mm-hmm. and comes up with books as the natural opportunity for a number of reasons. And Shaw and Bezos go for a walk in Central Park. And this, of course, becomes one of the founding legends of the commercial internet. And Bezos basically says, he wants to be an entrepreneur like Shaw. Mm-hmm. Shaw had left Morgan Stanley to start D.E. Shaw. And Bezos was inspired by that and by the financial opportunities of being an entrepreneur and owning your own company. And Shaw tried to convince him to stay, said he had, a great future at the firm and on Wall Street. But Bezos, taking the first of many risks to come, decides to leave a high-paying job, to leave the comfort of his Upper West Side apartment, and with his wife, Mackenzie, strikes out on his own.
Mm. It's interesting. Bezos concedes pretty early on that for example, books, he knows that a real everything store, as you mention it in the book, is going to be impractical at first. So he focuses on books, as you say. And I think this is one of the themes of the book, is he's very long-term oriented. He's not, I mean, you mentioned the story, I think it was 98, a vice president of the company comes to him and says, look, there are not a lot of Americans who are reading. Books may be a very limited market. And he knows this, Bezos does, but he knows that it's also just a beginning. And I guess the point is he has a very long view of this all.
That's right. And we see that even today where, you know, Amazon, despite these massive revenues, is losing money.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, because Jeff sees long-term opportunity. He says it's still day one on the internet. And in fact, if you walk into the offices, the Amazon headquarters in Seattle, there's basically a quote from him on a plaque saying it's still day one and there's a lot of opportunity to come. But sure, back then, he had hired all these people in the mid-90s that were passionate about the book opportunity,
yeah,
that were booksellers. He had editors writing reviews, and yet on a dime, he kind of turns and starts expanding. Now, he had raised a lot of money, you know, the capital. What really kind of, you know, inspired him, I think, was the easy access to capital at the start of the dot-com boom and the fact that they could go public early and raise all this money with bonds. And, you know, Jeff Bezos is the guy who raises more money than anyone, you know, about $2 billion in the late 90s, and it almost came back to haunt him. But at that key moment where they've raised a lot of money and that marketing vice president tells him, you know, our opportunity is limited because not a lot of people buy books. He says, basically, in that moment, you know, we're going to go for it. And you mentioned that at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that speech he gave at the Harvard Business School. Mm-hmm. Well, they ended up hiring a couple of MBAs, the first batch of MBAs from that class. And he took those business school graduates into a room and basically gave each of them a different market to research. And that's why they ended up selecting first music and videos and then toys and electronics as the immediate market expansion opportunity.
It's interesting. That's a great story, I think. I mean, as you mentioned, he gets a cab ride to the airport. And I wonder what that says, that he is always thinking, he's relentless in the way he's thinking, and also he can be kind of impulsive and willing to just sort of go with a hunch, I guess.
Well, right. So after that class, he gets a cab to the airport. And there are a couple of things going on there that would be amusing to an Amazon watcher. One is the company is frugal to the bone.
Yeah.
He doesn't get a cab ride. He gets a lift from one of the students.
That's right. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, early on, Bezos, who digests books, you know, he's a huge reader.
Right.
He had read Sam Walton's autobiography, and Walton is preaching the necessity of frugality for any retailer because your ability to set low prices is directly related to your cost structure.
Yeah.
And so Amazon, one of its core leadership principles and values is frugality. But it's not just talk. So one of the things that Jeff does is he just exemplifies this behavior. And so in everything he does at the company at that time, it's all cheap, you know. Everyone's building their own desks. They're staying in horrible hotels. They're flying coach class. And then, of course, Bezos gets wealthy and he's got his own private plane. But every time he gets onto the plane, he has to announce to everyone that the company isn't paying for it. He is.
Right.
Not only is in you know, hitching a ride from a student that he eventually hires from that class, not only is that, you know, Walmart style frugality transported onto Amazon, it's also Bezos kind of walking the walk and setting this example for his employees.
I'm trying to imagine those earliest days. You write about the summer, I think it was of 1995, and Bezos and some of those earliest employees, they're working late, Bezos is helping to fill orders, driving the boxes to UPS to get delivered in those. I mean, it was a really bare bones operation.
That's right. And the funny thing is that they kind of had no idea what they were doing.
Yeah.
In a charming way. They were experimenting, to be sure, but they really, you know, didn't understand, one, the levels of demand that the internet was going to bring their way. You know, I think in the very earliest years, you know, he thought of himself as an online bookstore, but you know, the internet's taking off. And it's not just the Amazon brand is getting bigger, but this is exponential growth. And they're struggling to keep up. And he doesn't know how to do logistics or supply chain yet. And it's only 1998 that they start to basically steal people from Walmart. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even work either, because the Amazon supply chain has to look much, much different from Walmart. But in the very earliest days, it's just the white collar workers that are in the small little Amazon office. And at night, they all go down into the basement to package books and drive them to the post office.
You described the early executives of Amazon as the equivalent of the doomed drummers of the band Spinal Tap, one after another just sort of, you know, being let go or leaving. So what does that say about the intensity of that experience? Because it seems really, really intense.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, the Spinal Tap comment was in more direct relation to marketing executives, where Bezos, for the first 10 years of the company, kind of plowed through him. And even today, it's a difficult role. And I just think that he's someone that wants to reinvent everything. He doesn't have a lot of patience for, kind of areas of the company that aren't as precisely measured. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just one reason why marketing has been a tough role to fill at Amazon. But in more generally, you are right that the early executives, Amazon kind of outgrew them. Yeah. You know, at Google, we can look at the senior executive team and find a bunch of people that were there in the very earliest days when Larry and Sergey, you know, were fresh out of Stanford mm-hmm. and starting in a Palo Alto garage. Those early executives are, a lot of them, still at Google. You know, they run YouTube or they run product or marketing. At Amazon, Jeff grew beyond them. One of his sayings was, we want to raise the hiring bar with each new employee. He wanted everybody to get better and better. And some of the early executives, you know, found themselves losing responsibility because the flashy new hire from Walmart or, Microsoft came aboard. And for that reason, I found a lot of frustration and some bitterness among that early group of employees. They, particularly the early ones, had made a lot of money. Yeah. They, of course, weren't complaining about that. They did very well for themselves. But I think there was a wistfulness that they had been on the ground floor in the very earliest days of this revolution, this company that changed the world. And yet, you know, Bezos, without showing much in the way of, remorse, had kind of just raced beyond them. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's one of his qualities that maybe has allowed the company to be as successful as it is, that he's constantly looking to scale his talent and find the right people. But at the same time, to some, it seems a little heartless. You know, it's kind of sad to talk to the guys like the first employee, Shel Kappen, that whole generation of folks who really believed in the mission and then found themselves kind of sitting by the side of the road as the bus drove on without them.
You know, it's interesting. The sort of corporate culture is interesting. You write about employees don't seem to have the same kinds of conditions at Amazon as you would see at Pixar, for example. I mean, you know, no breakfast cereal or ping pong tables.
Right.
I mean, they have to pay for their own snacks. They have to pay for their own parking. Is that still the case?
Well, Amazon subsidizes the parking, but not all of it.
Yeah.
And that goes back to frugality.
Right.
It's in some ways, it's a statement the company is an operation that is devoted to its customers, and in the hierarchy of priorities, you know, customers sit above employees. And I think, you know, Bezos has created a culture that strives to kind of highlight that prioritization in every possible way. And you find a lot of former Amazon employees in the fulfillment centers or in the headquarters, you know, offices that are in Seattle, but really now all around the world, who have some bruises from their time there and don't feel treated particularly well. And I think it's that culture of the company really oriented to the customer, to the detriment of almost everything else. You look at other retailers, and sometimes they're the the culture is the same. I think Walmart is similar. But then there are companies like Costco, you know, whose founder, Jim Sinegal, was really more of a union guy at the very beginning and, you know, created a company that is oriented towards treating its employees extraordinarily well. You know, Costco employees, it's not uncommon to find someone behind the cashier that's worked at the company for 2 decades and makes, you know, $30 or $40 an hour. So, you know, different cultures, but it's hard to argue with the success of Amazon and the way that it's grown really over the past 20 years.
You mentioned how Bezos likes to sort of codify his beliefs into these customs, and you mentioned that narrative presentation. I wanted to ask you about this. What seemed to me kind of a terrifying custom in some way, the OLR custom, which OLR means our least effective. Well, I'll have you tell this story because these meetings seem kind of frightening if you were an employee.
Well, right. Okay. So, lots of idiosyncratic customs at Amazon. We talked about the narratives and the 6-page documents, the press releases, building your own desks. Bezos really kind of created a culture from the ground up. You know, everything is sort of the Amazon way. There's been a lot of thought put into all these customs. OLRs are, I'm gonna mess up the acronym too, but I think it's operations and leadership reviews, and it's basically the meetings where promotions are considered. Now, scaling the ranks at Amazon has become very difficult. I mean, not only is the organization huge, you know, 100,000 employees, but they want to. Jeff has always wanted to keep it, the organization flat. He doesn't want a lot of levels. He wants doers and not managers.
Yeah.
And that's been true from the very beginning. And OLRs, all leaders at a similar level will gather to consider all the possible promotions. And a manager is going to have to present a promotion to his peers with a narrative, so a written out document, and you've got to discuss the strengths and weaknesses of the candidate, and then that possible promotion is pitted against other possible promotions, and it's open for debate. It's one of the many weird customs at Amazon. It's one of the reasons why some of the employees described it to me as a kind of gladiatorial culture. It's not easy, but I think that what Amazon would say, or what Jeff Bezos might say, is that what they do isn't easy, you know, and fulfilling customer promises isn't easy, and he's created a culture that isn't comfortable for employees, but you know, as a result, people work pretty hard there, as they work hard at companies like Apple and Google. And so, you know, I would guess, you know, Amazon turnover, it's a number they don't share, but I think it's probably higher than the industry average would be my guess. In the list of best companies to work for, you know, published by websites like Glassdoor.com. In fact, they published one recently, and Twitter, surprisingly, was at the top of that list. And you see Facebook and Google and Apple on that list of the top 50 best companies to work for. But Amazon is never on that list, or at least wasn't this year. And it's because they've created, you know, a hard-driving culture.
He's a micromanager, takes a red pen to press releases and shareholder letters and speeches and product descriptions. What's he like? I mean, he seems cheerful, but he's also has these high standards. I mean, how do you describe his? I mean, he's got the public persona, but what's the? I mean, he's also intensely private. He's really complicated.
Right. That's right. The easy comparison perhaps is to Steve Jobs. You know, another founder entrepreneur who managed to really inspire employees and lead a company when it was, you know, many tens of thousands of employees. I think Jobs could be a little more vicious in his attacks. The canonical stories are of sharing an elevator with Steve Jobs and kind of, you know, emerging from the elevator, either fired or at least, you know, with your head hung low, because he could be brutal. Now, Jeff, it's a little different. First of all, I think he's really grown as a manager over the last two decades. He doesn't seem to me ever deliberately mean. But like Steve Jobs, he's got a very high standard for his employees and executives, and he gets upset when people don't meet those standards. And so in my book, The Everything Store, I have one section where I just had fun kind of combining the comments that had been relayed to me by so many employees, the kind of Jeffisms. And they were things like, are you lazy or just incompetent? Right. You know, this is another example of how you are letting me down. If I have to hear that idea again, I'm going to kill myself. Does it surprise you? You don't know the answer to that question. All these things are kind of funny. I think unlike the Steve Jobs, you know, teardowns, you know, Bezos brings an element of humor to it. But look, I'm sure he can be terrifying to his colleagues, and it's because they want to please him, you know, because he's an inspiring leader, and everyone wants to make him happy and to help the company success. But you know, like all these guys, you know, he can be really tough.
Brad Stone is with us. His book is The Everything Store: Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Brad Stone. We're talking about his book, The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. He's joining us today from the studios of member station KQED in San Francisco. So you mentioned in your book that when you talk to Bezos' friends or his colleagues, and when you ask them, where does this competitive streak come from and where does all this come from, they always point to, or often anyway, the circumstances of his early childhood. Talk a little bit about that, how that influenced. He grows up in this tight-knit family, but also, you know, he's being raised by his adoptive father, but he has a biological father, and that's an interesting story. Talk about that part of his life, if you would.
Sure. You know, I wanted to understand, you know, this man who had, you know, built this company, was so relentlessly driven, was on a mission to build, you know, not just a lasting company, but I think one of the biggest companies in the world. And one of those, you know, unusual circumstances from his early childhood that had been referenced in earlier stories about Jeff Bezos over the years, but had never been fully explained, was, you know, the story of his parents. His mom was 17 years old when Jeff was born, and his dad was a man named Ted Jorgensen, who was 18, and they had met in high school in Houston. Now, the Ted Jorgensen story had never been told. You know, his name was on the birth certificate, but the Bezos family had said that, you know, they really had lost touch with him many years ago. Jeff had said in earlier interviews that he had never met him. So I decided to go find this guy and to understand what the circumstances were that, you know, led to the birth of this unusual man. And the first thing I did was I searched the local archives. Actually, it wasn't Houston. Sorry, it was Jeff Bezos was born in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The family moved to Houston later. So I searched the early newspapers in the 1960s in Albuquerque for a Ted Jorgensen. And to my surprise, the first thing I found was that he was a unicyclist, that he had been in this unicycle group, and they performed in circuses, and they had traveled the country playing unicycle polo. And Ted Jorgensen was, like, in the 60s, was constantly being honored for his skills as a unicyclist. Well, anyone who followed Jeff Bezos over the years, the man probably spent 5 years on a Segway. So the first thing that struck me was this remarkable coincidence. Like, is there some genetic predisposition for wheeled vehicles? And then finally I found Ted Jorgensen running a bike shop outside Phoenix. And I went, one of the last things I did reporting the book was I went to visit him in person. And I walked into his bike shop and I introduced myself and told him I was writing a book about, you know, this his biological son, Jeff Bezos, and Amazon, and he had no idea what I was talking about.
Yeah.
He did not know that his son was one of the most wealthiest people in the world, and that had gone on to create this company. And so it was just a remarkable, you know, surprise for me, and I hope an illuminating part of the book, where I was really able to, you know, tell Ted Jorgensen's story and tell the story of you know, Bezos's birth. And who knows? I mean, you know, maybe it ultimately had an impact. Maybe it didn't, because, you know, Jeff ended up having a very normal childhood. And Mike Bezos, who's a Cuban immigrant who married Jeff's mom when Jeff was five, you know, ended up being a great dad. And it's one of those unknowable things. But it is interesting that it's not just Bezos, but Steve Jobs and Bill Clinton and Barack Obama. And I mean, the list is long. Lance Armstrong, John Lennon, you know, these driven individuals who have some variation on the same story.
Do you have any sense how Jeff Bezos reacted to your discovery of Ted Jorgensen?
Well, I ended up telling his mother that I had found Ted, and I didn't get much in the way of a reaction. Yeah. But a couple of months after that, as I was finishing up the book, I'll step back and say that the Jorgensen family, you know, Ted was obviously astonished by my appearance in the store, and I had kind of explained, you know, what had happened, and he had really spent his whole life wondering what had happened to his biological son. He had a lot of regrets around how he had handled it. He had ultimately remarried and had four stepsons, and you know, had this very successful bike shop, but it was really a hole in his life. And when I, you know, presented these incredible circumstances to him, he was naturally curious. And wanted to get in touch with the Bezos family, and ended up sending letters to Jeff and his mom, Jackie. And then right as I was finishing the book, Jeff replied to Ted. He sent an email to one of Ted's son-in-laws, because Ted isn't on email. And it was a very nice note. It was, you know, essentially telling his biological father not to have any regrets on his behalf, that he ended up having a great childhood, and really wishing him all the best. That is as far as it has gone, as far as I know. I think, you know, probably Ted, you know, hope for something more, but it was also a resolution of this question that had nagged on him for many years.
I wanted to ask you about the acquisitions of Amazon. I mean, Bezos owns diapers.com. They now own Zappos.com, so shoes. Is there any sense that he's collecting? Or is this a business, or is it a little bit of both? You know, is it always business-centric, or is there something else going on?
Sure. Well, you know, actually, Amazon has done comparatively few acquisitions. You know, when you look at Google buying Motorola and YouTube for many billions, Amazon's acquisitions have been relatively paltry. But it does acquire, I think, when it perceives a competitive threat, yeah, particularly companies that are trying to out-Amazon, right, selling commodity products like shoes in the case of Zappos, or diapers in the case of diapers.com, at low prices, with great customer service and really flexible brands. And first it was Zappos, and then it was diapers.com, owned by a company called Quidsi. Mm-hmm. And in both cases, Amazon competed like heck and really ruthlessly pursued these companies. In the case of Zappos, you know, Amazon went and created another website called endless.com, mm-hmm, discounted where it could, and really hurt the profitability of Zappos. And it operated similarly to diapers.com. I mean, you could call it kind of predatory behavior. It's clearly, you know, competitive behavior, which there's nothing wrong with. And in both cases, the entrepreneurs behind those companies really ended up having no choice but to sell, right, to Amazon. So it's one of the reasons why Amazon tends to be feared by many in the e-commerce industry. But I also think that people have learned their lesson, which is if you're gonna compete with the giant, figure out something that they can't copy. You know, find a product category that they don't sell, or a kind of a customer proposition that they can't match. And it's why we don't see lots of Zappos's or diapers.coms showing up today, because they know that, you know, you can't really go head to head with Amazon anymore. It's too big and it's too strong.
It does seem it does seem aggressive. Maybe predatory is too strong a word, or maybe it may be the appropriate word. I mean, you mentioned how Amazon gutted Zappos' profitability. They had no choice, really, but to sell to them. How are you thinking about the impact? We mentioned this earlier, but I wanted to get you to say something a little bit more about the impact of a place like a company like Amazon on local economies, on those mom and pops. What effect Sure. are they having? Can you say?
You know, it's in some ways it's funny. I've started maybe getting a little more optimistic than I was, particularly when I wrote the book. I think that Amazon poses a real critical challenge to big box stores. You know, because the Best Buys and the Barnes and Nobles of the world, their proposition to customers is based around selection and price. I mean, you could put 150,000 books in a Barnes and Noble superstore, and because it's a giant chain with lots of stores, they can get great deals from suppliers. From publishers, and then they can discount books 15 to 20%. But Amazon's always going to trump them. It is now so big that it can 150,000 books is nothing to Amazon. It's got 5 million. And, you know, a 20% discount is nothing. It's going to sell used books for dollars or set an ebook price if it can at $5.99 to drive business and increase customer loyalty. So I think it's the big box stores that really face the biggest threat from Amazon, and the small mom and pops that offer something that's really different. In the case of local booksellers, I mean, look, they've been under attack for decades, and first it was, you know, Barnes & Noble and Borders. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, first it was the mall stores and then Barnes & Noble. So, I don't think you could lay that at Amazon's doorstep, the fact that independent booksellers are going out of business. It certainly made things worse for many years. But now the independent bookseller kind of offers something that no one else does, which is a personal experience. Maybe they bring authors in for talks. Maybe the owner of the store has personal relationships with customers. I think that it might be the mom and pop merchants with strong ties to the community that end up doing better in the age of Amazon than the big box stores.
You write about how in the late 1990s, Bezos is having all kinds of ideas. Friends refer to them as these fever dreams.
Right.
You mentioned his latest fever dream. Is that a project using these unmanned aerial helicopters, these drones to deliver these small shipments? Talk a little bit about that, because that's sort of, you mentioned that the so-called last mile problem is sort of one of the biggest challenges facing Amazon right now.
Right. How do you profitably deliver all these products to people's homes, particularly as they're expanding into groceries, and particularly as the service called Amazon Prime, their 2-day shipping program, you know, kind of frees up customers to buy impulsively, to buy one thing on a Monday and then another thing on a Tuesday. So increasingly, Amazon doesn't have the luxury of putting multiple items into boxes anymore and delivering something once a week. They're running to our homes, to the homes of their most loyal customers many times a week. Well, I think with the drone announcement, there are a couple of things going on. I mean, it was clearly a PR masterstroke. It was well-timed to Cyber Monday. Mm-hmm. Jeff wants Amazon to be like Google, a kind of moonshot factory, you know, taking these big bets and being seen by prospective employees they're trying to recruit as a real inspiring place. So I would put that as kind of number one reason behind announcing the drone initiative. But also, you know, he's always made these big, unlikely bets on technology. He did it with the Kindle. And I really do think that he probably believes that, you know, one day sometime in the future, this will be possible, and they'll be solving for some of the expense of their supply chain.
Do you have any sense whether he's got a really good fever dream related to journalism? As you know, he purchased the Washington Post not so long ago. Some think of it as a kind of an ego project, less than a business venture, but something's got to be working up in his mind to figure all this out.
Absolutely. I mean, he's clearly attracted to hard problems. I mean, that's the Bezos MO and the Amazon MO is to kind of climb into the muck of these low margin, high complexity problems like distribution to figure them out and to build businesses on top of that. And in some ways, you know, journalism in the 21st century is the hardest problem of all. So I think, you know, he didn't go looking for that opportunity. The Graham family presented it to him. There might be a little bit of a public relations aspect to that as well, and it probably helps in terms of magnifying his impact in Washington, D.C. I just think he felt that his kind of congenital optimism and his resources could help an important public franchise. And I'm sure, you know, for the folks in the newsroom at the Washington Post, it's been a great thing because, you know, no longer do they have to mind the pennies because they've got a really deep-pocketed backer. And they're also free to experiment, you know, with tablets and paywalls, which is something that really every news organization needs to do right now to find new ways to deliver value to their readers.
I wonder if it, in some way he'll go back to another theme that comes out in the book is his everything is customer centric. If he's going to be able to figure out how journalism can serve the customer, and that may be the saving grace.
That's I think that's probably certainly important to them it seems like some of the things that some news organizations are trying, like paywalls, aren't all that reader friendly. You click on a link and you really want to read it, and suddenly you need to present your email address and your password and maybe a credit card, and you 99% of readers are going to give up. So I think a little kind of reader centricity is going to help. It's also, you know, in journalism, it's a tricky thing because, you ask people kind of what they want to read and sometimes the bar gets lowered. And of course, the Washington Post has an important mission to cover Washington and politics and the world. So it's interesting. It's in some ways the Amazon model of customer focus will work really well. And then in other ways, he's going to have to invent some new models.
Yeah. Let me ask you, less than a minute left. Let me ask you this finally. There's this epigraph you include in your book of a Bezos a commencement speech at Princeton a couple of years ago where he says, in the end, we are our choices. What does that say about Jeff Bezos ultimately?
Well, that he's moved with what he calls the regret minimization framework, which is, you know, when he's 80 years old, he doesn't want to look back and regret any roads not taken or any opportunities not seized. And so I think, you know, not only is it relevant in terms of, the story I tell around the biological parents and the father and the choices they made that led to this unique individual, but also the choices that Jeff has made with Amazon to really push his foot onto the accelerator and seize every possible opportunity and to never stagnate. And it's something to consider as we watch this company, you know, probably over the next 10 years grow to one of the biggest companies of the world.
It's Brad Stone. His book is called The Everything Store, Jeff Bezos and the Age of Amazon. He joined us from San Francisco. Brad Stone, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.